Shasmarena Rav Shlita. Thank you, Michael. I say the Shila Ilu Nishmas, the father-in-law of Jeff, Rav David Ben Rav Meir, and we also say it for a Refuah Shleima for Jeff's grandson, Habocha Eli Mordechai Ben Abigail Chava, the Soch She'ech Olei Yisrael. I'm very flattered to see Rav Meir Salaznik present, a very good old friend from over 40 years ago, when we last learnt together, must have been about 42 years ago, as a Chavrusa. So he was saying to me that given the space of 42 years, he thinks the next time he'll come to him, he will be in 42 years' time. Abaleinu
l'tova. Very nice of you not to say what age I'll be.
Yeah, he did say he'd be 106. Rav Meir has done amazing good work over the years in Bushi, and I believe you have or about to have an Eruv there, is that right?
There's an
Eruv there now, and it's one of the Choshev Kehillos which Meir has built up, and the credit is really due to him and his dear editor. So I hope you enjoy your retirement and get lots of nachas, not only from your children and grandchildren, but also from the Kehillah of Bushi.
I keep away from it because I have a wonderful successor. So we get involved in Hanukkah.
I see. Well, I thought it was a sufficient cover to be called Chosn Torah and to go through that role in a most overwhelming experience, which is a memory for a lifetime. But even that doesn't seem to be enough for the members of this shiur, because on Chol HaMoed, Michael knocked on my door with a gift from all of you, and I'm extremely grateful. Not necessary. I will do this even without gifts, believe me. But the one who benefits most from this is myself, and the feedback which I get from such a wonderful crowd. But thank you very much. Very kind. Now, some people ask me, what are you going to talk about when you say
to the people that organise it.
I beg your pardon?
Say thank you to the people that sorted
it. Heckle the role.
Thank you for the people who organised everything, Simchas Torah. Thank you for everyone who's organised this. It's an amazing Kehillah, one big warm family. Now, some people were asking me, what are you going to actually speak about when they saw the title? I said, well, that's what it's about, Tray for Utensils. Yeah, but what are you going to talk about? I think they were worried that I was going to talk about unfiltered smartphones, but that is not the subject of my topic today. It's Kipshuto, Tray for Utensils, but it's such a wide subject, it might need a part two, part three, part four, but it's such a wide subject that what I intend to do is just ask one simple practical question, and then from that to derive various principles on the subject of kashrus, which can help our general knowledge on it. It's, as I said, a wide subject, so any personal queries have to be forwarded to a reliable rabbinical authority. But it's a funny thing, kashrus, how some people, quite rightly you might say, are very machmir on certain things, are very cautious because it's very difficult to trust others. I recently met a fellow from Germany of all places who's going through a gerus, and he's also a vegetarian, and I said to him, what do you say to people when they ask you why you're a vegetarian? He said, well, it depends what sort of people they are. If they're left wing animal rights activists, I tell them about cruelty and how I should be kind to animals and that it's humane. If they're middle of the road orthodox people, I tell them, well, you know, it's a healthy form of diet and I feel better from it. But if it's Haredi Jews, I tell them I don't trust the Shechita. My Rosh Yeshiva once told me that, he said to me, how do you trust the family when you go to them if you know you can eat at their table? He said, if you ask a question and the answer you get is, well, what do you think we are? Of course we're kosher. He said, that sort of house you don't eat in. He said, if you ask a question, they say, well, I got this from Kosher King, and I got this from Rice Caterers, and I got this from Be Kosher, and we were very muckbid about this and muckbid about that. He said, you can be definitely sure you can eat in such a household. So much so that one Rav of Golders Green said to me, he said, there's a difference also between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. if you see an Ashkenazi who walks in the street without a kippah on his head, then you don't eat in his house. But if you see a Sfarzi who walks in the street without a kippah on his head, you may still be able to eat in his house. That is also an interesting idea. So my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Meir Shlesinger, he was once sitting at a house where they had another guest. This was in America, but the guest was from Eretz Yisrael, and he was sitting at the Shabbos table, and he brought his own food with him. Well, you know, he's going around, he's collecting for some moysev, and he doesn't know whom he can trust, so he carries around his own food with him. So the lady of the house said to him, "You brought your own food with you?" He said, "Yes." She said to him, "Well, where are your kalim?" She had in front of him plates and knives and forks and silverware, and he pointed at those. She said, "Well, I'm sorry, if you don't trust my kashrus of my food, then you can't trust my kalim." And she took away from him the cutlery and the plate, and he just had to eat his own food with his fingers. Well, quite logical and consistent. I mean, some people won't accept any heksher. There's a story of the rabbi who came to heaven, and the angels told him that a special feast was being made for him, and he asked, "Who is the mashgiach?" And the angel said, "God himself is the mashgiach." He said, "Thanks, I'll just have the fish." But I was once, many years back, involved in a summer camp, and the kitchen staff was so machmir about anything to do with kashrus that if a fork or a knife fell on the floor, they would call it treif. I don't know if they were discarded with it or if they kashered it, but they call it treif. But this is pure ignorance. It doesn't happen that way. And in fact, it's quite difficult to actually treif something up. Although my wife, and I'm sure many wives, have a section aside for various forks and knives which require kashering, it is in fact very hard to make something treif if one is aware of the principles. So much so that my wife thinks I'm a bit of a reformed left winger when I tell her that something is still okay, but it's not for me to decide. Well, let's now come to our basic concept of kashrus. We want to discuss principles of kashrus. The Rambam is of the view that kashrus is very much a hygienic thing, that the non-kosher foods are not healthy and they're not good for you, but the Avarbanel and others decry the Rambam and argue fiercely against him, saying that kashrus has nothing to do with health, it's got nothing to do with hygiene, it's purely gezeres hakosav. This is what Hashem has told us. We don't understand the reasons which the Torah gives us for something which is tantamount to a chok, and we do it because that is the Rotzon Hashem. So that's the generalized background. The simple question I want to put forward is one which may affect us when we're traveling, and that is, you have no food with you, you forgot to bring with you, and you're in an area where there's no kosher food, and you go into a supermarket and you think, well, what can I eat? Now, it might be very nice buying a packet of cashew nuts, or even they need checking, but sometimes you might feel for something a bit different. It's true that certain breads are now pasakum, though, are carrying a heksher from LBD and SKA, which you can get in many supermarkets, but you do see some very healthy fruits which have been cut up, like pineapple or mango or kiwi fruits. And you think to yourself, I'd like to have one of those, but I don't know what sort of utensil or knife they were cut with. Can I buy them? And that's really a simple question which I'm going to address today. And we'll just work our way through a few principles, and that will be the shear in its total. And if I finish early because it's not such a huge subject, well, so be it, then you will have plenty of other things to do. But it's something which has become very prevalent now in the supermarket, where they are selling people who want a quick lunch, not just their sandwiches, well, those are a problem, of course, if there's no heksher, but if it's the cut-up fruit such as melon, pineapple and mango, well, why not? It's a healthy food, but how is it prepared? We don't know. We're not allowed access to their kitchens. And it might not simply be a Tesco or Sainsbury where they might have a huge department specialising in such a thing. It might just be some shopkeeper at the back of the shop who's got these things ready, and it might not be one of the multiple names. So what are the principles we should look at in order to determine whether you can or cannot buy such foods? Well, one of the most important principles in kashrus is how to make something trafe, and it's usually transferring through heat. And certainly you're not transferring through heat when you're dealing with melon or pineapple or mango. And what does heat mean? Yad soledes. Some differences of opinion. What is yad soledes? Whether it's 40 degrees, 45 degrees, some say 43 degrees. And it's where the temperature, not simply in which your hand would be scalded by the hot water, but could your hand actually stay within that hot water? It's an important principle in Hilchos Shabbos when you are mixing foods of different temperatures, but we won't go down that route today. And so if you have foods which blend, mix with each other, and there is heat, then that is the problem which is tantamount to becoming trafe. And similarly with utensils, if something, let's say, is boiled in a utensil, like a mixture of meat and milk soup is cooked in a utensil, that utensil becomes trafe, that saucepan can't be used. It's possible it might be possible to kasher it, and if we have time we might say something a bit about kashering later. But that is the first principle, the transfer of heat. So if trafe of food falls onto a hot pot, and even if it's removed immediately, so let's say a trafe of piece of meat, let's say it wasn't salted, falls into a hot pot, then that pot becomes trafe immediately. There may be certain questions about proportions and bittul, but we'll come to that in a moment. In Hilchos Tarumos, one of the first principles it mentions is nishpach. Nishpach means if liquids meet each other, and nishpach means it becomes absorbed, that you can no longer trace the source. Like a drop of milk falls into the meat soup, then there's no way you can trace it. There's no way you can remove it from the meat soup. Certainly if, let's say, a piece of kneidlach, which is trafe for some reason, or let's say it was made with milk, falls into the meat soup, you can take it out. That's not called nishpach. But you may still have a problem, though, of kashrus, because of the residue which fell into it. But that is the principle. And if something is not nishpach, then there are two kinds of taruos. Min b'mino, min sheba'eino mino. Something which falls into its own kind, like a trefa egg goes amongst other eggs which are kosher. We're not dealing with that subject today at all. We're really dealing with min sheba'eino mino, one type which falls in a food of another type. And when there is some wetness involved, then the principle of taruvos is 1 in 60, as a general rule. So we'll come to that. If something is soaked for 24 hours, even if it's cold, then it's as if it's called cooked. It's called kovush. Kovush kumavushal. So whenever something of this nature happens, then the utensil is affected, and that utensil would become trafe. There is another principle called reicho milso, which is aroma from something. And this will happen, let's say, in an oven, when you get the smell of one food coming onto another food. Or it might be a food which releases steam, and that's called zeo. The literal meaning of zeo is sweat. Well, shall we say perspiration, or you know what they say, horses sweat, men perspire, ladies glow. I don't know what it says about the chicken soup, but if there is something in the oven which transfers as a result of zeo, then in normal circumstances, like two foods being baked in an oven and they're not covered, then one will trafe up the other. Simon Tzadi Beis and Ramah Kuf Yud Ches in Yeridea. So on the principles of bittul, Tam Ke'ika D'Araisa is, it's essentially a matter of taste. If taste is imparted from a trait of food, then it makes the other food and the utensil non-kosher. If it's so minimal and minute that there's no taste imparted, then it won't trafe up something else, and the din of bittul will apply the nullification. The problem is, it's very difficult nowadays to measure whether something is trafe because of taste being imparted. the beginning of Hilchos Taruvos does talk about, well, you can get a non-Jew to taste something for you. Lefit Tumo, you don't really tell him why you're asking him. And if he says there is still a taste, then there is a taste. And if there isn't, there isn't. But we're not really experts nowadays in imparting taste or not. So the general principle is 1 in 60. So, if there is such a minute drop of milk which falls into that meat soup, then it's definitely less than a 60th, then that meat soup is still okay. And it might be quite remarkable sometimes when it's more than just a teaspoon, because it might be a very large vat of soup. But it will still be okay. And obviously you're not going to be dumavatlin mechachila. You're not allowed to say, well, I've put in already some milk and I'm not sure if it's a 60th or not. So I'll add some more of the meat soup and that way it will certainly be bottled. That's cheating. You can't do that. And there's a knas on that. But that is the general rule, if it's nishpach, and if it's removable or not removable. But there are some things which are never bottle, some things which are never nullified. One kind of concept is dovah she'esh le'matirit, something which is not allowed now, but will be allowed later on, or if some action is going to be done with it. And if that happens, that can never be bottle, that can never be nullified. Examples of a dovah she'esh le'matirit: the Isser of Chodosh is something which we haven't yet discussed, but may be doing so in the near future. And that is any of the five kinds of grain which have been grown and have not yet reached the 16th of Nisan, when we have the Korban Omer brought in the Mikdosh. Well, we don't have the Mikdosh nowadays, but many people will wait till the 16th of Nisan until they eat from the new crops of grain, wheat, barley, rye, oats, spelt. Usually there's a time lag. I once asked Rabbi Cooper's Upsol many years ago about this, and he was under the impression that many kinds of grain are stored away in warehouses for as much as 3 or 4 years. But recent evidence proves that some early crops, like those which come from Canada, arrive here in December, January, and you now do see announcements from the Adas about Chodosh, but those who are particular should wait until after Pesach before they eat such foods. So the weird thing is that you get some bakeries advertising old flour. You know, normally bakeries will say how fresh and modern they are, and they'll say fresh flour. But the more charedi a bakery is, it will say old flour. And the reason why I said many people is because many rabbonim are not so particular nowadays on Chodosh, Bizman Hazer, because Chutz Laretz and Sofeit and the Bach writes on this, but that's a subject for another time. My late great uncle, Diane Posen, who was on the Kadassia based in, had a principle not even to answer questions about Chodosh, because it will cause undue hardship on many people. So that's the subject of Chodosh. But Chodosh will become allowed after a due period of time, so it's called a Dovah She'esh le'matirin. Another kind of Dovah She'esh le'matirin is Tevel, something which has not been meistered. So food which has not been meistered, one doesn't eat. But such food from Eretz Yisrael, once the mice has been taken, it's allowed. So if Tevel gets into a mixture, then we say it's a Dovah She'esh le'matirin. The Dovah She'esh le'matirin is not allowed, and therefore the 1 in 60 doesn't apply. Afilu ve'elef lo bottle, even 1 in 1,000.
Would it apply to uncultured meat as well?
No, uncultured meat we don't call a Dovah She'esh le'matirin.
Unsalted
meat. Yeah. Because once it falls in that soup, it's not kasherable anymore. Yeah. So we don't call that a Dovah She'esh le'matirin. No. Somehow it might come to my mind. My mother used to ask me to do on her an April Fool trick every year, and I didn't really want to, but she wanted it. So once she asked me to get some meat from what was called Froines, and it was just before Pesach, and it was 1st of April. So she said, "Did you collect it?" I said, "Yes," but they didn't have time to kasher it. So don't worry, I'm going to salt it all. And she got into a bit of a worry, and I said, "April Fool." Anyway, but it's strange that, you know, kids nowadays have no idea about how to kasher meat, and I think it's important that they should lead, even though it all comes ready done from the shop. Well, chometz is a debate whether it's a Dovah She'esh le'matirin, because chometz on Pesach obviously you can't eat, but after Pesach you can eat chometz. Alright, chometz in your ownership during Pesach, chometz shoval after Pesach is a problem as well, but chometz min haTorah is allowed after Pesach. But there's an argument between the Rambam and other Rishonim. Why? Because next year that chometz becomes forbidden again. So the pshat of sheshem matirin is that it will be allowed afterwards, but allowed for all time. But chometz is not allowed for all time because it will become forbidden again. So that's a debate. There are other things which can't be nullified in 1 in 60. One is called a biriot, a creature of its own, like an insect. Since it's something recognizable, it's given more chashivos, it's given some more importance. So that complete creature, like an insect or an egg, which is in an unhatched state in the bird, that's already called biriot, that can't be potel. A piece of meat or other food which is a portion with which one can honor somebody with, a guest, that is ready to be served. This is a portion of food which is fit for serving. That has chashivos, it's got importance. That can't become bottle if it's mixed up with others. There's also something called davar sheva minyan. Because of chashiva, something which is sold in units, identified by numbers, like a dozen eggs. So each one of those eggs has a number to it, is different to other foods, that is davar sheva minyan, and many say that that can't be bottle either. So that's the principle of bittul. So,
but then you have with things like trimmers and masters, you've got 1 in 100, 1 in 200.
Right, it's true. The Orlah is bottle 1 in 200. There are certain exceptions to the rule of 1 in 60 in other forms, yes. And this principle of Einu bottle afilu be'elef, some say if it's 1 in 1,000, then it is bottle, because of the expression afilu be'elef, that once you're over 1,000, it's okay. But Hilchos Taruvos is quite complex for a half an hour share, and it's just to give over some general principles, but it's a fascinating subject, and the last chapter of it, Simon Kuf Yud, I think it is, has principles of Sofek and Svek Svek on, when there's a doubt or there's a doubt of a doubt, and there are 36 principles given there on Svek Svek, which can give plenty of reason for any rabbi to issue a heter. But I have to be careful what I say here, because we have here men of the cloth and they might disagree with me on some things I'm saying. But that is the general principle of Hilchos Taruvos, that it might be quite hard to make something trace. Right, so we spoke about some principles of transfer with heat, with something soaked, reikon milso, they are. But if there are sharp foods, something which is spicy, then that may make it more difficult to say that a utensil is still kosher. Because even if your temperature has not gone up and you don't have a hot food, if something is spicy or for that matter greasy, then that can impart a trace product into the utensil to make it inadequate. What are the foods which are called sharp? Radishes are mentioned by the Gemara. And you wouldn't have thought that a radish is something so sharp, but horseradish certainly. Garlic, onions, olives, lemons are regarded as something charif, sharp. And the Chazon Ish says that where we say on Hilchos Shabbos that you can put tavlin into a keli sheni, lemon, he says, is called tavlin. It's a spice. Melach for tavlin. So there's another principle, and that is benyumo, or eino benyumo. What's benyumo? Something which is within 24 hours. Or a utensil which was used in the last 24 hours for boiling meat soup. Are you now putting into it a mixture which is from the last 24 hours, or is it more than 24 hours? What's the idea of 24 hours? So Chazal say that after 24 hours, the taste of the issa becomes bad, it becomes inadequate, it becomes distorted. So after 24 hours, there's a principle called nosein tam lefgam. And if there's something which is nosein tam lefgam, then we are more lenient in any judicial decision about utensils being treif or not. There is a view that certain items like dishwasher powder can create a nosein tam lefgam. A dishwasher powder, so some will even go as far as saying, but not most rabbonim don't agree with this, that when you do a dishwasher wash, that wash is the notion tamlef gam, so that if the utensils in it, like milchik forks, are used as fleishik forks afterwards, it won't really matter because you had a notion tamlef gam. But most will not go along with that view. But it's also a subject which can be discussed regarding Hilchos Pesach at some stage. So even if 24 hours have not passed, when you've got sharp foods, and such sharp food is mixed with dairy, and those sharp foods might be meaty, then you have a problem. So the Dovah Charif negates even this post 24 hour heter of Nosen Tamlef Gum, because it's not totally okay after 24 hours, and then if you've got something sharp, it like revitalizes the kalim of what had been used before. So for example, if onions are fried in a dairy pan, and that dairy pan has not been used for more than 24 hours, so you might say, well, it's no time to gum, so it's not properly dairy pan anymore. And if those onions are fried with chopped liver, then no good. Why? Because the onions are charif, are sharp. That's just one example. Or if onions are chopped with a dairy chopper, or cut with a milk knife, then those onions cannot be used with meat. Whereas if it would have just been some vegetable like carrots, which have been cut with a dairy knife, then they can be used with meat. Even though most housewives will not want to, it can be done that way. There is an argument as to whether onions are called sharp. Reb Chaim Volozhin had this opinion that that according to Gemara, onions were not really in the category of sharpness. And a woman came to him, a poor woman who was in a panic, Erev Shabbos, that she put an onion which she cut with a milk knife into her meat soup. And so he said to her, what colour was your onion? Because apparently there were also black coloured onions as well as the brown coloured onions which we are accustomed to. We also have red coloured onions, don't we? And she said it was brown. He said, oh, well, in my opinion, the onion being referred to by Poskim is a black one, and therefore he allowed it. But he didn't want to publicise the fact that he differed in opinion to the Shulchan Aruch, who was talking about onions. His opinion, based on the Gemara, was that onions did not come in the sharpness category. But it is a sharp food, certainly in the way we would understand it. There's another principle called nut bar nut. Now, that's nothing to do with cashews or pecans or almonds. Nut bar nut, it stands for no same tam bar no same tam. No same tam means to impart a taste. So you can imagine then, you've got a saucepan which has been used for meat soup. Then if you boil water in it afterwards, the taste of the meat is given over from the walls of the saucepan into the water. So that water becomes meaty water, which you can't drink with milk. But let's say you had milk boiled in a pot, and then you boiled another food, certainly that will receive the taste of the milk. But if you have a secondary reaction, namely that after you've boiled your meat soup, then you had water boiling in it, and that water was then boiled somewhere else in another keli, and that imparts a taste to the next utensil. That might be called nut bar nut, no same tam bar no same tam. And there's a bit of an argument about this. According to the Ashkenazim, you cannot rely on no same tam bar no same tam. It's still too direct. But Fadim are lenient in some circumstances. Now let's say that the no same tam is not so much with boiling in the pot, but it's just hot food touching the plate. So let's say you've got hot fish placed on a clean, cold, meaty plate, and it had meat on it in the last 24 hours, so it's called plain pneumo. The fish can be eaten with dairy, right? So that is a form of nut bar nut, but it wasn't actually boiled in the pot. The fish is hot, and when you've got heat, you have an imparting of taste. And that fish is placed on a clean, cold, meaty plate. So there's no hot plate there which is imparting anything. And that plate has been used in the last 24 hours where hot meat had been on that plate. Nevertheless, Gemara Chulin Kuf Yud Aleph says you can eat the fish with dairy, even though it's like nuts bar nut, and we don't normally allow nuts bar nut.
Sorry, confused. Why is this in this?
Well, there has been meat on the plate,
yeah,
which you will say imparts a taste into the plate.
Yeah.
You're within 24 hours,
yeah,
so it's benyumo.
Yeah.
That plate then becomes cold,
yes,
and you have a hot piece of fish on that plate.
Yeah.
It's kind of nut bar nut, but we allow the hot fish to be eaten with dairy because it's not sufficient strength to impart the trefa, well, the meat taste into the fish. It's not sufficient because the plate has meanwhile become cold and has been washed and cleaned. But, well, it seems that even Ashkenazim will allow that.
Don't eat meat with milk and fish together.
No, they don't. So, it is a weak taste which might be transmitted if you have hot food on a cold plate or cold food on a hot plate. Some say if fish is boiled in a meat pot, then you need 3 transfers before you might allow something like that. So meat to the pot, pot to the water, water to the fish.
I'm sure that the Rav mentioned,
yes,
that if you have fish, let's say, that's been cooked in a meat pot,
yes,
that meat pot, let's say, hadn't been used for 24 hours, and you can have that. I'm sure you can have that.
Oh, if it's not been used for 24 hours, then the principle of no St. Harmless scum will kick in.
Yeah.
And that after 24 hours, we say the taste is distorted. So the Shulchan Aruch is more lenient on nut bar nut because he's writing for the Sfardim, but the Ramah, who writes for the Ashkenazim, is more strict. But b'di'eved, certain, especially when there's cases of great loss involved, there may be certain leniencies applied. But things are best to avoid. The chachila, you know, we want to get rid of any sphaitis whatsoever. But the Rosh in Chulin writes, he says, you can't eat fish which is boiled in a meat pot with dairy.
Well, even if the meat pot is more than 24 hours?
Yeah, but it can be placed, even hot, on a milk plate. But not eating it with some cheese or something like that.
Even if that pot was more than 24 hours, if it hadn't been used for more than 24 hours?
Yeah, so if well... The question is, even if it's benyumo, that's the thing. So afterwards, then, yeah. If a fish is cooked in a non-benyumo pot, so it's more than 24 hours since it was last used, it may be eaten with dairy.
Yeah.
So because the nut's bar nut, and we say no sin tamlef gum. So if you bite the... If no sin tamlef gum kicks in because of 24 hours of fast, and nut bar nut, then you've got the heter. On the sharp foods topic, some say that if the sharp food can be eaten alone, then it's never called sharp. Sharp is something which you use as a dip for something else, something which is really charif. But if such a food you would never eat on its own, then some say like pickled cucumbers,
herring,
or sauerkraut, herring, you'll eat it on its own, that's never called charif. There is such an opinion. Now, let's come to our subject of the knife, because our subject really started with about the cut fruit. The knife has a different kind of category to other utensils, like saucepans or plates or forks, because a knife cuts and cuts with force. And there is a principle called duchko de sakino. A knife applies pressure, and when there is this pressure, there might be a greater chance of absorption. So there are cases where we might be more strict with a knife. So we say that sonic tracer can transmit and absorb in ways unlike any other utensil. Because when you've got... Alright, when it's cold, then you won't get the transmission. But when you've got the heat combined with the duchka, the sakino, then we are more strict. Especially if even if there's no liquid or grease, when there is something like that, then it makes it more. So even if it's less than Yad Soledes, even if it's not so hot, there can be a problem when there's a knife because of duchka de sakino. On the other hand, when it's something like a spoon or a fork, which falls into a cold tray for liquid, you can just rinse it. Good enough. What say if a knife does cut in cold tray for meat? Let's say you've got a Milchik knife which cuts salami, which is not likely to be called greasy or sharp, and it's cold. Then that Milchik knife, you just give it a good scrub with your fairy liquid and it's okay. Wash it cold. But if the knife goes on warm meat and you've got the pressure combined, then you've got a problem, then that knife should not be eaten and the meat shouldn't be eaten. But when you've got cold transfers which are sharp food, then you've got a problem as well.
So if it contains something like onions or garlic?
If it contains onion or garlic, then you've got a problem. Certainly, lechatchila, you'll never use a milk knife for cold meat. And you won't even cut your bread with a meat knife for a dairy meal. Mm-hmm. If that's the case. You will try and keep those as part as possible. But now we can come back to our question about the fruit. Or vegetables, for that matter. I mean, let's say you're cutting vegetables which are not sharp. So there's no taste imparted. A meat knife will not impart taste to a cold, non-sharp vegetable. So if you're cutting cucumbers and tomatoes and carrots, you don't have a problem. And duchkosasakino is not a problem either, on its own. But if there's a residue, if the knife wasn't clean, then you will rinse it. Now, when you've got fruit cut with a meat knife, it's not so easy, because when you cut fruit with a meat knife, if there was residue on the fruit, we say that that residue which gets on the fruit can't necessarily wash off. It might have become absorbed. So it might be a problem. So you won't then rinse the fruit if it was cut with a meat knife, because it might become further absorbed. But you can then scrape that fruit with a palmer knife. Scraping is called gerado or gerero, and that will enable you to eat the fruit. But if the knife was clean, then you can simply, you might wash the fruit if you want to, and you can eat it with dairy if it was a meaty knife, if there was no sharpness on the knife. So where does that leave us?
Does fruit, things like pineapples, does that count as sharp?
Pineapple is not sharp, no. So this question is discussed by Rav Binyamin Forst in his Sefer on Kashrus, Rav Yehuda Balsam, quoting the Ramah. If a shopkeeper uses knives to cut fruits, we assume that they reserve a special knife for that purpose. Certainly with the big ones like Tesco and Sainsbury, they'll have departments which are just preparing fruit, and they'll have special knives for that purpose. And the Ramah actually says this in Simon Sadivov, Sif Beis, we presume that the shop keeps separate knives to cut things like fruit. And we presume that that knife was clean, because they're under health and safety regulations, for goodness sake. The council's inspectors are coming round to make sure that they're running a clean way, and if they see one cockroach, they'll shut the place down. So obviously, before they use their knives, they'll make sure that those knives are clean, even if it's just for hygiene purposes. Furthermore, there is a concern of these shops not to ruin the taste of their pineapple or mango or kiwi. And certainly they know that if they've used the knife, say, for fish, non-kosher fish, they're not going to use that knife for the fruit, because it will impart a smell. And nobody wants to buy cut up pineapple which smells of fish. So again, they say, we can safely assume that that knife has not been used for cutting anything else. And nowadays there's another issue, and that is there are allergens, and people are worried about causing allergic reactions from one food to kind of another food, and you know, this product may contain nuts. Have you ever bought a packet of cashew nuts when it says this product may contain nuts? Well, so people are allergic to certain foods, so they're very careful to separate different foods and to separate the utensils which are used for certain foods. And so Rav Eliashiv wrote that it's safe to assume a clean knife is used in such circumstances. But there are certain authorities who want to be machmir, Sefer Madonai HaShulchan, based on a Shach and a Taz on the Shulchan Aruch, but we got the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah to rely on. They may be worried about the sharp foods, but and so on and so forth. But there's an interesting psak which comes from the Ramah, and that is something different. And that is, we discussed the rules of Bittel, of nullification, and the 1 in 60. So let's say there was a knife which was used, and it wasn't Tesco or Sainsbury, it was some shopkeeper at the back who uses a knife for multiple uses. So let's say he wasn't that careful, and let's say his knife wasn't even 100% clean, and there was some residue on that knife, and this is an important chiddush. Then you can assume that the first couple of pieces of fruit had the residue on it, but then the subsequent piece of the fruit did not have the residue on it. And with the amount of fruit that he's cutting, you'll get the 1 in 60. So it'll be bottled. And therefore, you don't have to worry about the knife which was used, even if it did impart some taste or residue, because that would be only on the first and second or third cuts. But then on the subsequent cuts, it won't be imparting that residue or taste anymore. And therefore, even if that knife was from the supermarket's meat department, and it was used nevertheless to cut lots of melons and pineapple, and therefore those first cuts will become bottle amongst the whole lot.
Isn't the 1 in 60 rule only for the evidence?
For the evidence is not really used. We did talk about chaticha, really, scobes and certain items which are not nullified in 60. But in these sorts of circumstances, we say that 1 in 60 rule applies. Yeah. And once something is bottle, yeah, okay, l'chachila, there is the thing that you don't mix up things. But the evet, it's happened already. Once it's happened already, and you're in a shop, and you want to get some nourishing food, which is not just, say, a packet of crisps that has the LBD hexer on them, because you can get that anywhere. But you want something, you know, you're on a raw food diet, so you want to eat this cut fruit, you're allowed to do so. Ah, but what about fruit including lemons? Lemons are sharp. But if there is a large quantity, then we'll also use the principle of bittul. But the shach and the taz wish to be machmir. Anyway, I think I'm going over time. We can't really talk about hagola today, but there is kashering possible for many utensils, metal, stone, wood, leather, bone, rubber. But porcelain, glassware, earthenware, we say can't be kashered. But that will be a subject for another time. It's been fairly daring to venture into a subject which you don't usually get shurim about, because the issues can become quite detailed. But it's important that everybody knows what the principles are, so that you know what information to give to the Rav when you ask your shaila. Or you can anticipate what questions he will ask. Was it hot? Was it cold? Was it spicy? Was it greasy? And that, you know, the best way of asking a shaila is to know your information before you ask it. Come along with a safer open. And that way, the chokhmah isn't simply to know how to answer a question, but to know how to ask a question. Thank you very much.
My mother's quite old now, and we had to get a carer for her, who's a non-Jewish person. And so if she cooks, and I checked with the Rabbi Cohen, if she cooks for my mom, that's Bishurakum. And that even makes the pot tray.
Yeah, but there are a number of issues, and we can perhaps do another share sometime about having a non-Jew in the house, and what about the utensils. But Bishul Akum only applies when you can't eat the food raw. It only applies to food which is served on Shulchan Malachim. There are various conditions. We did once do a share on Bishul Akum.
Yeah, of course. But people should be aware of it, that if you have a goy, and I should have known of it having come from where I grew up, that if you have a goy in the house, you've got to watch the kelim.
Yeah. It can be a big problem with kelim.
And it makes the kelim trace as well.
Agreed. Yeah, one has to be very careful. All right, a subject for another time. Thanks for the idea.